Well, if you will, take your Bibles and turn to Matthew 17. If memory serves me correctly, it's page 822 in your pew Bible. You can check that in the bulletin. Matthew 17, this morning, Lord willing, we will go through verses 14 to 20. Matthew 17, verses 14 to 20. I'll start reading in verse 14. And when they came to the crowd, a man came up to him and, kneeling before him, said, "Lord, have mercy on my son, for he has seizures and he suffers terribly. For often he falls into the fire and often into the water, and I brought him to your disciples, and they could not heal him." And Jesus answered, "O faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him here to me." And Jesus rebuked the demon, and it came out of him, and the boy was healed instantly. Then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, "Why could we not cast it out?" And he said to them, "Because of your little faith. For truly I say to you, if you have faith like a grain of a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you." This morning, we come to a passage that focuses on one of the things that you need the greatest clarity on in life. We come to a subject in which you will never survive the life to come if you misunderstand this issue, and the issue is faith. And because of the world that we live in, because of God's revelation to us, we stand in need to understand this idea of faith, both as a creature and especially as a Christian. We need to understand what faith is. But the problem is, there may not be a more misunderstood concept than faith in the world around us. For instance, it's not uncommon to turn on the news and you see people interview different faith leaders. What they mean by this is these are people who represent different faiths. So the idea that there are multiple faiths, and the way our culture is, the less defined and less clear you are with your faith, the better for them. And so no one can look at one faith leader or one faith and say one's any better than the other. You can't say one's wrong unless you're the one saying others are wrong, then you're wrong, and so forth. Or maybe you've heard this at funerals or just in meeting someone. They'll describe somebody. They'll say, "Hey, so-and-so is a great person of faith." It's like, yes, they are, because they're a human being. It's like saying this is water, and what makes it great is it's wet. That's what water is. And so when you describe someone as a person of faith, you haven't said anything in one sense. What you mean is they're really committed to what they believe, which is true of every single human in human history. So we could go on and on, but it's clear from these kind of examples, and I'm sure your experience, that faith is not only one of the most important issues you could ever understand, and coupled with that, it's one of the most confusing things if you look out in our culture. Again, this is tragic because if you're wrong on faith, you're wrong on one of the most important things. And I'll even say this, if you are wrong on faith, you can't be saved. And so again, this is not something to play around with. As if being saved along with faith is not important enough, what we learn in our text this morning is if you are a Christian, you also have to be clear in what we mean by little faith. What I'm trying to explain to you is the stakes are high, and when it comes to the issue of faith, you can't go to sleep on this issue. You can't settle for a lack of clarity when it comes to these kind of things. So this morning in Matthew 17, we're going to get some clarity from Jesus. The way that I outline this story to help us grasp from it what we can is two simple points. You first have a public failure, and then secondly, you have a private lesson. So a public failure and a private lesson. So let's start in verse 14. I want to show you this public failure, but I want to remind you, before we start reading verse 14 again, I want to remind you where we've been, because it's been a pretty dense couple of weeks here. I want to remind you that in chapter 16, Jesus approaches the disciples, and he says, "Who do they say I am?" The crowds. And the disciples basically say, normal Jane and Joe, Jewish person, says that you are some sort of good prophet from God. They stop short of the Messiah, but you're not normal. So they're kind of in the middle ground there. And so Jesus then turns it, says, but who do y'all say I am? The 12 disciples. Peter, speaking on behalf of the 12, says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus responds by affirming this, and then Peter hears the explanation later that Jesus must go and suffer and die and be raised. And Peter says, not a chance. That is not going to happen with our Messiah. And Jesus rebukes him, says, get behind me, Satan. And so here Jesus clarifies what his role is and then says, not only am I going to die, but if you want to follow me, you sign up to die as well. And then in order to encourage Peter, James, and John, Jesus takes those three up on the mountain, and they hear a conversation between Moses, Elijah, and a glorified version, if you will, or view of Christ. Now in verse 14, they're coming down the mountain. Look at verse 14 again. And when they came down, notice, to the crowd. So by the time that these four men, Jesus and the three disciples, get to the bottom of the mountain, there's a crowd. And if you combine Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you get a full image of what's going on here. It seems like they come up, and Mark lets us know that there's an argument going on between the scribes and disciples. So the nine that were left at the bottom of the hill or the mountain, those nine are in an argument with the scribes, and it's such an intense argument that crowds have developed. You're kind of in the schoolyard, if you will. So Jesus says, what's going on here? And it seems like there's crickets from the disciples. It's kind of like your parents come back and you just kind of doodle your foot in the ground and look down. It also seems like the scribes aren't saying anything either. So here's Jesus showing up. He says, hey, what's going on? And all of a sudden this guy pops out of the crowd and he's like, let me tell you what happened. Look at verse 14. And when they came to the crowd, a man came up to him and kneeling before him said, Lord, have mercy on my son, for he has seizures and suffers terribly, for he often falls into the fire and often into the water. And I brought him to your disciples, and they could not heal him. So this man who pops out of the crowd happens to be the dad of the son that's in question here. Again, when you combine the synoptic gospels, that's the three minus John. We want to work through Matthew, but I want to give you kind of a big picture, a bird's eye view of what's going on here. Apparently, when Jesus and those three go up the mountain, the nine stay down here, and they continue their kingdom preaching, kingdom miracle working ministry. And it seems like they come across a boy that for whatever reason, we'll get into it, for whatever reason, they're not able to drive the demon out of him. And so this son suffers from seizures. We'll find out later it's caused by a demon. On top of that, he suffers terribly because the demon flings him into fire and water and threatens his life daily. So the dad brings the son to the disciples. The disciples try. They're unable to do it. It seems like the scribes take note of this, and I'm assuming here, but this would have been great a weapon to use against the disciples, saying, some Messiah you got there. You can't even heal a little boy. So the crowds start developing around this argument. Jesus comes down. You've got disciples who have failed. You've got scribes who feel emboldened in their persecution, if you will. You've got crowds that are back to their middle position, not knowing what to do. You've got a little boy who's still suffering and a dad who's left with a burden. So Jesus comes down from the transfiguration to a mess. Again, I want you to feel the weight of this scene, this literal mountaintop experience, coming down to just messy chaos. Again, we often grab Matthew 17 and we want to run to the mountain-moving faith part, and you forget to look at the context in which it lives. So let's make sure we catch what Matthew's saying. Look back at verse 14. And when they came to the crowd, a man came up to him, that is to Jesus, and kneeling before him said, Lord, have mercy on my son. Again, I want you to just notice this dad is in need. I know these are basic observations, but don't miss it. Sometimes we rip the humanity of these people out of the stories, and we'll get more into it, but this dad comes up, falls on his knees, and is begging Jesus to have mercy on his son. Again, I don't want you to miss the humanity in moments like this. This dad, as some of you can relate, is incredibly pain-filled and in trouble. His son that he greatly loves is hurting. Verse 15, look at it. Lord, have mercy on my son, for he has seizures and he suffers terribly. So the dad starts off saying, listen, the reason that I am in such need is my son suffers from seizures. I think some of your versions put epilepsy. Because of what verse 18 says, we know this is not normal physical problem with seizures. It's caused by a demon, and Mark explicitly points that out. So again, try to imagine yourself as this parent, the dad or the mom. Your son not only has a demon controlling his body, and you are helpless, but the demon often threatens your son's life, and by all accounts, the situation seems hopeless. But then you hear these disciples come into town. They've got a good track record. You've heard of people. You know people who've been healed by these disciples. So with great joy and anticipation, you take your case to the disciples, and they fail. The son's suffering continues. The dad's burden continues. No one's helped. There's more torture from the demon at play. In the account in Mark, when Jesus says, "Bring the boy to me," the demon does it again right there in the scene. So these disciples have failed, and because they've failed, they've caused great harm to continue. Again, you got to think of how miserable life would have been for both the dad and the son. For the dad to see his son go through this, to live with bruises and scars and burns, to constantly worry about his son drowning, to constantly worry about his son jumping into a fire uncontrollably. And then imagine being the son. Imagine you're eating lunch and out of nowhere you just lose control of your body. I mean, you're constantly living with pain, wondering when the demon's going to re-attack you, if you will. And again, it's in the midst of that misery that he gets hope. Verse 16, look, "And I brought him to your disciples. They could not heal him." Again, as I've said several times already, you got to put yourself in this dad's shoes and think about how miserable this would be. And especially when you've gotten your hopes up again, and then they just come crashing down. And so it seems to be at this situation, the scribes take note. They're ready. Right? This is an easy target for them. Because you remember earlier, Jesus did his miracles, and there's no arguing. The dead actually rose, the deaf actually heard, the mute actually spoke, the paralyzed actually walked away. Those things actually happened. So their only defense was, he's in cahoots with Satan. They couldn't deny the miracles, so they just had to pick on how they were done. Here, the disciples can't even do the miracle, and so this is easy for them. Again, I'm imagining that they would have picked on them, saying, "Some kind of Messiah you've got there. This boy's in great need, and you worship the King of the world. How about that? He can't even drive a demon out." Again, I want you to keep in mind the close relationship of a disciple with his master. When the disciples failed, it came across, this is not reality, but it came across as though Jesus failed. Because to bring a problem to the disciples was to bring a problem to Jesus. In fact, Mark says, the dad says, "I brought him to you." Well, Jesus wasn't even there. This is similar to when Paul is abruptly confronted by the Lord in Damascus, on the road to Damascus. And he says, "Why are you persecuting me?" It's like, "Well, I've never touched Jesus. What are you talking about?" Again, there's this relationship with Jesus and his people to where this man comes to the disciples for help, and because they're unable, it brings reproach on Christ. So here you have the disciples failing, those nine that were left. You have a boy who's hopelessly suffering, a dad who's unbearably burdened. You have scribes who are justified in mockery. You have crowds who are emboldened in their unbelief. You have disciples who are depressed because they aren't able to do what they thought they could do. And again, it's this kind of a mess that Jesus steps into and responds. Look at verse 17. "And Jesus answered, 'O faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you?'" And then he says, "Bring him here to me." Jesus gives what I'm calling a sanctified sigh here. Jesus never sinned. Jesus never sinned in thought. Jesus never complained. But here we see him crying out, "How long am I going to bear with these faithless and twisted people?" Again, he says, "O faithless and twisted generation." And my understanding, speaking to the people here, maybe the disciples are lumped in, but they would be exceptions. Kind of like when we say there's no faith in Israel. We know there's pockets of exceptions. Here, Jesus lumps the generation of Israel he's dealing with into this faithless and twisted generation. faithless because here's your king. You say you love God. You say you've got great faith. And here's your king right in front of you, and you don't believe. Again, here's God standing right in front of you in flesh, and you're proving yourselves over and over again to be faithless people. You may think you love God. You may think you have faith. You may think you want the Messiah to come, but I'm here, and you don't want me. Again, Jesus is rebuking them for not turning and trusting him for their deliverance. And on top of that, he says, you're a twisted generation. Again, some of your versions perverted. Not perverted like we think in the sexual sense, but twisted, perverted, meaning turned. It's not what it's supposed to be. Think about it this way. What more evidence could these crowds have wanted? Jesus has said everything he needs to say. He's done everything he's needed to done. And they see it. And what do? They twist the evidence. And their problem's not a evidence problem. Their problem is a faith problem. They don't see, and they don't want to see. That's what we learn about the human heart in Scripture. And it's this kind of people that Jesus gives this sanctified sigh at, if you will, and says, how much longer will I dwell with you people? Again, comments like this, they remind us of how patient Jesus actually is. I want you to think through just this last week. I don't think we have to dig very far back. It could even be this morning for you. Think of how short your fuse is. Think of how quickly your buttons are pushed. It's sinful anger. We can call it whatever we want to. Think about how quickly you get this idea of, I am surrounded by morons. I mean, you think that probably on a daily basis, right? Depends how old your kids are or what family you have in town or anything like that. Who you work with. And it's so easy for us to get in this self-righteous position where we just think, man, how could everyone around me be this blind and crazy? And then we're just put to shame by the patience of Christ here. Jesus actually was surrounded by sinners, of which he was not one. Jesus actually was surrounded by people who constantly went against him. And still we see, even after this sanctified sigh, we see great patience. He still says, bring me the boy. He could have said, all right, that's it. You know what? It's been over 30 years. I am done. You guys are not worth it. You are far more hassle than you are benefit. I'm gone. But he doesn't do that. He endures. He patiently waits with these hopeless sinners in one sense. And in verse 18, after he says, bring the boy to him, he notice, and Jesus rebuked the demon and it came out of him and the boy was healed instantly. So now Jesus and the boy are in front of each other, and Jesus speaks to the demon, and like we've seen every other time, when he speaks to them, they go, emphasizing his lordship over them. And Jesus drives this demon out by command, and the boy is healed. And now while I cannot know for certain all the effects of this, I'm imagining, I think with a sanctified imagination, that the dad is relieved, the boy is happy for the first time in a long time. The scribes have their mouths shut or their jaws are open, one of those two responses. You have the crowds who are now reinterested in Christ. And then you have the disciples who are sitting there in shame saying, why couldn't we do this? Again, all this came about because of the public failure of the disciples. And I want to notice a couple things. One of these hurts a little. The other one is a great comfort, so stick with me. The failure of these disciples, these nine at the bottom of the mountain, it was not a private failure. Sometimes we convince ourselves that our sin is private and, oh well, no one will know or it won't matter to anybody else. And their failure was not private. It was very public and it greatly impacted other people. Their failure was not an irrelevant event. It mattered greatly. Think about the dad. Because they failed, the dad continues to be burdened by this son. And I don't mean he doesn't want to be burdened by it. I just mean he's got to carry his son around with the idea of at any moment he could lose control, he could die. His life is a vapor on a daily basis. You've also got the son who's constantly suffering. You've got the scribes now who continue their mockery. You've got the crowds who continue to doubt. And it's all because the disciples didn't do what they were supposed to do. You don't want to use a moment like that to remind you that your sin is never as irrelevant as you think it is. Sometimes we try to console ourselves by saying it's just not that big of a deal. No one else is going to get hurt. But everyone involved in your life suffers when you aren't pursuing holiness, when you aren't growing in holiness. Again, when you're lazy spiritually, others suffer. When you are relaxed in your pursuit of holiness or dismissive in your eagerness for maturity, you do affect other people. Again, of course, God is the one who saves. God is the one who causes growth. But as we've said many times, God does this through means most normally. And normally those means are other humans. So with your regression spiritually, you are not being used by God to help someone else grow. By your justification of sin in your life, others see it, they hear about it. They start justifying it in their life. Or maybe your own justification of sin, your own laziness of sin in your life, you get a little less fervent in your attack on holiness. And so when others aren't as holy, you aren't as quick to talk about it. Because, hey, which one of us is perfect anyway? Again, you got to think about being these disciples for a moment. And I want you to answer. Are those scribes responsible for their own rebellion? I got the air conditioner by my ear. Are those scribes responsible for their own rebellion? Yes, they are. But what we see is their continued rebellion is excused by the disciples' failure. Is it God's role to heal the boy? Yes. But what we see is the means of using the disciples doesn't happen and the boy's suffering continues. So here's their public failure, and they fail hard. It had to be humiliating. It had to be miserable. We'll see in a minute it was bewildering. But I want to remind you also of a comforting part of this, and I want you to never miss this idea. Their failure was not meaningless. Now, in no way do we want to go, well, that was good that they failed. That is not the point. But what I want you to understand is they are not perfect. They knew that before. This failure, what it does is it exposes them to an opportunity to grow and learn, and Jesus capitalizes on it. This is not a failure that was meaningless. These crowds aren't continuing in their rebellion, and scribes in mockery, and dad in burden, and son in suffering. They're not continuing in a meaningless way. God has a purpose in every bit of this. Again, failure and success, joy and pain, good and bad, all of it is included in the all of the all things that God works out for good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. So I want to show you with the second point that this public failure is not wasted because Jesus uses it to do a private lesson. Again, Jesus takes them, and when he's in the house, Mark says, they come to him privately and talk to him. Look at verse 19 again. And what you'll see as we turn to verse 19 is the disciples are left shocked. They're left wondering what in the world went wrong. Look at verse 19. Then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, why could we not cast it out? I want you to notice the obvious thing here. Jesus is not approached by the disciples. They don't say, Jesus, how'd you do that? They know how he did it. What they do ask is, why couldn't we do it? And that question assumes they should have done it. So take, for example, you've got a child that is demonized and you bring that child to me. I will give it the college try, but I cannot promise you anything. And if I don't help, I can't act like I failed because I don't have that power. I'm not a demon driver. That's just not in my job description. But for some reason, when these men tried to do it and failed, they were upset. They were confused. I thought we were supposed to do this. I want you to turn over to Matthew 10. I want to show you why. Matthew 10. This is a passage we looked at several months ago, and so it's probably far behind the back burner. Matthew 10, verse 1. I want to remind you of what Jesus did for these 12 that he did not do for the other disciples. He does not promise to every Christian. He did it for these 12. Matthew 10, 1. And he called to him his 12 disciples and gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal every disease and every affliction. Look at verse 5. These 12 Jesus sent out, instructing them, go nowhere among the Gentiles and enter no town of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel and proclaim as you go, saying, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out what? Demons. You can go back to Matthew 17. The reason the disciples were shocked they couldn't cast out demons in Matthew 17 is because in Matthew 10, Jesus told them, go do it. And they had done it previously, it seems. Jesus gave authority to these 12, and he gave ability and promises to these 12 that none of the other disciples were told, or we are told, that they had. Jesus empowered these 12, and he promised these 12 that these things will be done. And so they should have been able to help this boy. They should have been able to use the power that they have and use the promises that they have to help. They both had power and a promise to do things just like this, and yet they failed. Again, they come up to Jesus and they say, why could we not cast it out? And Jesus' answer to the question is the gold in the passage. And Jesus answers them in a way that helps them understand what went wrong, but he also answers in a way that helps you understand what faith is, what faith is able to accomplish, what's possible with faith. And so why couldn't they drive the demon out? Look at verse 20. He said to them, because of your little faith. So here we are again, I think for the sixth time. Little faith is being mentioned in connection with the disciples. The disciples have repeatedly heard, in Matthew it seems, this same thing over and over again. And on the one hand, it's encouraging because the crowds are faithless. At least we have a little faith, right? But it's also discouraging because my faith isn't what it should be. It's little faith. And again, they have genuine faith, but little, as Jesus says over and over again. As we said last time we were on a passage like this, little faith is short-lived faith. It's quickly out of breath faith, if you will. It's like the runner who signs up for a 5K and after 100 yards bends over on its knees gasping for air. A genuine runner, you're registered, you're in the race, you just can't make it very far. In order to give a good grasp on what this means, I want to actually go back and read each time it's mentioned and remind you of what's going on, because those contexts really help us understand what little faith is. Go back to Matthew 6. Matthew 6, we are way back in the Sermon on the Mount here. Matthew 6, Jesus talking about not to be anxious. He talked about providing. He talked about birds of the air, flowers of the field, those kind of things. Notice Matthew 6, verse 30. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which today is alive and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, will he not more clothe you, O you of little faith? In Matthew 6, you seem to have people who know that God can provide as long as they can see it. As long as they can figure out how God's going to provide, they believe God will provide. But the moment that God's provision seems confusing to them or seems impossible to them, their faith gets winded, they double over, and they start doubting. Turn over to Matthew 8. Matthew 8, verse 26. Matthew 8, verse 26 says this, and he said to them, why are you afraid, O you of little faith? Then he rose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. So here we are in chapter 8. We're on the sea with the disciples and Jesus. Everything's good. Everyone's confident. You're glad you got Jesus in the boat. And then the storms hit, and his care and provision doesn't seem as obvious. Your life seems threatened. And so what do? They have little faith and they start to doubt. Look over at chapter 14. Chapter 14. Verse 31. Jesus immediately reached out his hand and took hold of him, that's Peter, saying, O you of little faith, why did you doubt? This is where Peter walks on water. An incredible scene, right? Peter is doing something that definitely took faith. If you are a human being who steps on water and expects to stay on water, you're either trusting what God told you to do or crazy. It's one of the two. So Peter hears Jesus command him, step out on the water, and Peter steps out by faith. Everything's good. Then the waves, intimidating, the wind intimidates him. He starts to doubt and he starts to drown. For the fifth reference, go to chapter 16. We just saw this a few weeks ago. Remember, Jesus fed the 5,000 men. A little later, fed the 4,000 men. And then this happens. He warns the disciples about the leaven of the Pharisees. They start worrying about where we're going to get bread from. Chapter 16, verse 8, but Jesus, aware of this, said, "Oh, you of little faith, why are you discussing among yourselves the fact that you have no bread?" Again, as I said, they just witnessed Jesus feed 5,000 men, and they just witnessed Jesus feed 4,000 men, and now they're worried about bread. So again, it's easy to trust Jesus when the things are obvious, when it's clear how he's going to provide, but then when it's not so clear, when it's harder to see, you start to doubt. So you can go back to chapter 17. What I want to take away from those kind of references is it's easy to trust God to provide clothing while you're wearing a jacket. Think about that. It's easy to trust God to provide food while you're chewing. That's the easy part. The hard part is when your plate's empty or your back's bare. That's the hard part to trust God. Again, when things don't look clear, when things don't make sense to you, your knee-jerk response is usually not, and I'm assuming here, it's usually not, "Look, I don't know how he's going to do it, but he's going to be faithful and we're going to trust him." Usually, little faith responds this way. It says, "Look, I don't see it, I don't understand it, so it probably isn't true." Again, little faith is where a Christian's doubt begins. Again, little faith can see and little faith can trust. It can, but only when things are obvious and easy. When God's ways make sense to you, your faith is good. You're good to go. But the moment that God promises to do something that you can't see or figure out, you recoil, you pull back your hand, if you will, and you assume something's wrong, and so you doubt. Again, you start drowning like Peter, or you start worrying where your bread, like the disciples, or your clothes are going to come from. The whole time you're forgetting that you're fixated, you're fixing your eyes on the issue at hand because you can't figure it out, rather than thinking about the God who is over and in every situation. Again, you can never settle as a Christian for that kind of faith. A little faith Christian life makes life far more miserable than it needs to be. Again, you need real faith that is seen in verse 20 of Matthew 17. Notice what Jesus says. He said to them, "Because of your little faith, for truly I say to you, if you have faith like the grain of a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you." Now again, I want to clarify, just right off the bat, Jesus is not talking about different size faiths. It's not like, oh, he's got a great one and he's got a little bitty one. Because he says here, notice, the smallest one can do the greatest thing. So it's not you need to go for bigger faith. That's not the idea. Jesus' point is, if you have genuine faith, notice how even if it's as small as a mustard seed, it's able to accomplish the impossible, which is moving a mountain, which, by the way, has never happened in human history that I'm aware of by a person having faith. We have had faithful Christians for thousands of years, and not a single one of them have said, "Hey, mountain, move over a couple feet." The reason is because Jesus isn't being literal here with the, "You'll say to that mountain, and it'll do this." The whole mountain moving language is a phrase they had for overcoming seemingly impossible obstacles. Jesus' point is, no matter what the hurdle is, no matter what the obstacle is, if God has put it there, if God has told you to do it, by faith you can do it no matter what it is. This is very similar to Paul's Philippians 4:13. "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." The mustard seed here, again, is picturing this teeny tiny seed able to do something like move a mountain. You'd be hard-pressed to come up with something bigger on the earth than a mountain. And Jesus has said before that the mustard seed was the smallest seed, referencing those that they used in his day. And so Jesus is explaining here what's possible with faith. Now again, I want to clarify, not because something is special about faith in itself. It's not like if you just have faith, we often say that, you just got to believe. But we don't answer the what question. Just believe what? Again, the magic is not found in faith itself. The power is found in the one that you're trusting, the promises you're trusting. So Jesus is illustrating what he makes explicit in verse 20. Look again. "If you have faith like the grain of a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move." And so here's his summary of that illustration. Nothing will be impossible for you. Now, if you're a good real estate agent, you remember three things. What are they? Come on, what do you have to remember? Right, and that's good Bible study as well. Location, location, location. Context is king. When Jesus says nothing is impossible for those who have faith, it's not like what you see on TV, where if you just believe, you can get this or that. Jesus' context defines what nothing means. Verse 20 in Matthew 17 has a context. Remember, the disciples just failed. What did they fail to do? They failed to do what God told them to do. They failed to do what God promised they could do. They failed to do what God empowered them to do. They failed to trust God for what he promised. So when Jesus says nothing's impossible for you, the idea is if God has promised it, if God has said to do it, by faith, it is possible. Again, it might be evangelism for you. It might be patience with someone who is hard to be patient with. It may be counseling, a tough situation you're not sure about. It may be loving your enemy. But if God has commanded it, as Christians, he has promised and empowered us to accomplish it. And by faith, it can be done. So again, as we think about this, I want you to ask yourself, do you find yourself exercising little faith? Do you find yourself on a day-to-day basis, a week-to-week basis, however you look at it, do you find yourself going through life with this thing called little faith? Do you find yourself often getting winded because it's really hard to trust God when things don't make sense? A more helpful question would be this: do you want to do something about it? No, I can't promise you a silver bullet. It's like, hey, take these two pills in a week, you'll have strong faith, don't worry. What I can do, and I want to do as we end here, is I want to look at this idea of little faith, compare it with enduring faith, which seems to be the opposite. So little faith is quick-winded, long-winded faith is what we're after. I want you to turn to Hebrews 10. Go to your right, Hebrews 10. Go through all of Paul's letters. And the first one you're going to hit is Hebrews chapter 10. The first thing I want to point out to you is you need endurance. You can't settle for a little faith Christianity. Hebrews 10, verse 36. For you have need of endurance. Why? So that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. Again, to state the obvious, you need endurance because without endurance, you will not receive what God promised. Again, your need for endurance is clear, but I want to be more helpful than that. I want to ask, how do you get it? How do you get more endurance? How do you get greater lung capacity or greater faith capacity if we're using that illustration? Again, as odd as this may sound, your little faith is strengthened and grown, and I'm mixing my metaphors here, but little faith is increased by seeing better. You will run longer in the Christian faith when you see clearer. I want to explain what I mean. Remember what we saw earlier, what we studied about little faith. Little faith clings to God when things are obvious and easy. It does not cling to God when things are hard and difficult to see. When you hear God's faithful, but you don't see it with your actual eyeballs, your eyes of your heart tend to not see it either. So again, we ask the question, what does little faith need? Little faith needs to see better. You need to see truth with your heart that your physical eyeballs don't see. What I want to point out with this is backwards from what you normally hear. And that is this: faith is sight. I know we normally hear the other, right? Faith's a leap in the dark. But biblically, faith is sight. Unbelief is blind. Faith is sight. Look over at Hebrews 11. I want to show you what I mean. And if you pay attention, it's going to sound like I'm saying the opposite of the passage. But I promise, I don't think I am. Hebrews 11, verse 1. Now faith is. So, hey, here's a great verse if you want to know what faith is. Because it says, faith is. Now faith is, notice first, the assurance of things hoped for. When you think about faith, the first thing you need to think about is assurance. I know something. God has said something. God has promised something. And the reason it's called hope here is because it just hasn't been accomplished yet. That's what biblical hope is. Hope in the Bible is faith in God's yet-to-be-fulfilled promises. But the passage doesn't stop there. Faith is assurance of things hoped for, yes. But notice, it's the conviction of things not what? So I'm saying faith is sight. Hebrews 11:1 saying faith is conviction of things not seen. But the word seen here is being used with fulfilled in mind or eyeballs in mind. I'm saying even though it's not fulfilled, even though it's not seen, your heart sees it. The eyes of your heart, Ephesians 1, they see what God has said, even though it's not fulfilled in front of your eyes. Again, faith is sight. What I mean by that is even though you don't see what God is saying practically, you still know it's true because of what the eyes of your heart see. This is why faith is spiritual sight. People around you will tell you you're crazy. What do you mean Jesus rules? Have you seen this world? Why do you keep saying he's going to return? It's been like 2,000 years. He's nowhere to be found. Why are you Christians stuck in the dark ages where you say this about marriage and this about gender? Don't you know what science says? I mean, you have all these reasons around you that you see and hear with physical eyeballs and ears, and yet by faith we go, look, I know what God says is true. This idea is carried throughout Hebrews 11. Those of faith are the ones with sight. Those with unbelief are the blind ones. Verse 7, look at it. By faith, Noah, being warned by God concerning events as yet unseen, in reverent fear, constructed an ark for saving his household. Notice, Noah had not seen a flood. God just told him it would flood. So if you go to Noah and say, hey, Noah, about that whole flood thing, you know it's never flooded before, right? It's like, yep, I know that. You still think it's going to flood? Yep, it will. This is because he saw it by faith. Look at verse 13. These all died in faith. So he's summarizing a lot of the Old Testament faithful. Not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. Notice, they died in faith, not receiving. That would be the Hebrews 11, 1 version of see. They didn't see them. They didn't embrace them. They saw them far off. They greeted them far off. They shook hands with someone who was miles away, is the imagery here. They all died without seeing what was promised, but they did see it because they saw with the eyes of their heart. And unlike little faith, this means they saw when it wasn't easy. This means they saw when it wasn't as clear to everybody else. Again, when God commands you or promises you something, you see his promises and you see his commands as good and true and faithful, even if all the evidence around you points to the contrary. One of the best examples, and I say that because it's brought up again in Romans 4, is when God tells Abraham and Sarah, you're going to have a baby. Everyone around should be laughing at that. And yet if God said it, you can bank on it. It's going to happen. And by faith, Abraham saw it. And so if you want your little faith to become enduring faith, you must see with clarity what God has promised and empowered you to see, even when it's hard to see. Again, I know if you're a believer here this morning, you hear that, and you go, yes, I want that. I want to be able to see better when it's hard to see. And so I'll ask another question. How do you see better? How do you get this kind of sight? How do you get this kind of enduring faith that even when things are hard, I still trust? First thing I want to do is be clear. Colossians 1:11 says, being strengthened with all power according to his glorious might, for all endurance. The first thing we got to say is if that's what you need endurance, you need to be praying for it. God gives it. Now I'm going to go through a couple verses here. You may just want to write these down unless you just are itching to pull out the sword drills. If you're standing there going, yes, I know I need endurance. I know I need better sight. I know I need little faith to grow. I know that. Or little faith to endure. First of all, God's the one who has to give it. But, as we normally see, he promises certain means to use. So Romans 15:4 says he uses the Old Testament for this. For whatever was written in former days was written for our instruction, that through endurance and through the encouragement of the Scriptures, we might have hope. So I say the Old Testament because in Romans 15 it says the former things. But when it says the Scriptures, we apply that to the whole Bible. I need the whole counsel of God, Genesis to Revelation, for my heart to grow in endurance. On top of this, Hebrews 12:1 says that you endure as you repent. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that's set before us. If you are a runner, extra weight and extra baggage slows you down, makes you tired quicker, makes you stop and pause and catch your breath. But when you repent, when you're slinging off these weights and these sins, you're able to run with more endurance. 1 Thessalonians 1:3 says that endurance is a fruit of hope. He says, remembering before our God and Father your work of faith and your labor of love and your endurance of hope. So the way that faith produces work and love produces labor, hope produces steadfastness. So as we saw earlier, hope is trust in God's yet to be fulfilled promises, and trust in these future things causes you to endure. Again, God so builds and God builds an endurance in you by giving yourself to the whole Bible, to a life of repentance, and by having more and more hope in his yet to be fulfilled promises. But there is one more that is the worst of them all. And I say that trying to speak plainly. It's not really, but it is the way it feels in life. Romans 5:3 says this, we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance. Listen, if a ball is not involved, I don't want to run. Unless someone's chasing me to threaten me, or I'm running after a ball, I don't really care for running. So I don't know much about running, but I know this. The only way you're ever going to build endurance as a runner is to completely wear yourself out over and over again. That's why it just doesn't sound fun to me. But that's another story. If you say, well, I only endured this long, well, you've got to keep going that long to get further. You've got to keep going till you can't go anymore so that you can go more. You've got to go until you go, that's enough, I'm done, to learn that you're not actually, that's building you to go further. And that's what suffering does. If you want faith to endure, and you want faith that sees even when it's hard to see, God's going to have to put you in situations in which it's hard to see, where it's hard to continue. And he's going to do that over and over again so that you build endurance. Because then you'll get to that mile marker where you used to have to quit, and you go, well, I've been here before, and I can keep going. Again, it's by putting you in situations where it seems like God's not faithful, where it looks like God's promises have failed. It's by putting you in that pressure cooker, if you will, over and over again, that your endurance is built, and you still see, even though it's really hard to see. That's why some of the older people in the faith, they'll go through things that crush us younger people, and they go, oh, you haven't seen anything yet. You think mile one's hard? Wait till you get to mile 37. Again, God does this to build endurance. By faith, you continue to walk in obedience because of what you've seen in your heart, not with your physical eyeballs. I know it looks like God is unfaithful, but I know he's not. I know it looks like things are out of control, but I know God's sovereign. And this is how Matthew's account in chapter 17 is going to encourage us. These nine failed. They failed miserably. They failed in an embarrassing way. They failed in a public way, a painful way. But it was also used by God to bring them to have more endurance. Jesus used it as a teaching moment. And you know what? These are the men, these failures in Matthew 17, are the men that Acts says turned the world upside down. So we never want to justify failures like this. We never want to excuse little faith. But we also don't remember it's never wasted. If God has gifted you with faith, then he has promised to cause it to endure. He has promised you to not leave you with little faith. Like Romans 8 says, we quoted it earlier, God works all things together for good for his people and his glory, and that includes your failures and your actions of little faith. So the encouragement from Matthew 17 is don't quit. Continually come to Christ. Continually come to the whole counsel of God. Give yourself to God. Persevere in suffering. Pray more that God would use suffering rather than get you out of it. And as you keep coming to Christ, remember he is the wise and good and gracious Christ. Even when people have little faith, he is far more patient and kind to them than they have ever been to him. Let's go to God now and ask for grace with these things.